Welcome to Let's Talk Memoir, a podcast for memoir lovers, readers, and writers. I'm your host, Ronit Plank. Today, my guest is Mimi Zeman. She is the author of Tap Dancing on Everest, A Young Doctor's Unlikely Adventure, and The Post-Row Monologues, a play that has been performed in multiple cities. A board-certified OBGYN specialized in complex family planning, she has also co-authored 16 editions of Managing Contraception. Her writing has appeared in The Sun Magazine, Miss Magazine, Newsweek, Dorothy Parker's Ashes, NBC News Think, The Forward, and other publications. She's spoken nationally and internationally and has been interviewed by major media outlets. Ranking high on her list of favorite things are a good adventure, dancing, and a rich cup of coffee. Welcome, Mimi.
Thank you so much, Ronit. I'm delighted to be with you.
I'm so happy that you're here. And I would love to get started by having you share a bit about Tap Dancing on Everest.
Sure, of course. Tap Dancing on Everest is a coming-of-age memoir that connects my background as a child of immigrants who arrived by ship in New York City and becoming the doctor and only woman on a historic Everest climb in Tibet when I was a 25-year-old medical student. It has themes of search for identity, feminism, medicine, and adventure. And it also highlights the restorative power of immersion in nature and in solitude, which I think is very important today in our overstimulated world. I pitched it as Wild meets Into Thin Air with a Jewish and feminist twist. Because the wild part is a few chapters when I backpacked solo through Nepal at 22. Mm-hmm. And the Into Thin Air part is the latter half of the book, which is our Everest expedition.
Yeah, there is so much material that's interesting and different, and there's so many elements at play here. And as we talked about before we started recording, it was hard to pick where I was going to have you read, because I thought we have to talk about all these different hats you wear and how your life has moved. Well, let me ask you something. Before I get to the question I'd planned, I would love to know about your pitching process and how you settled on that pitch and where you approached. Like, did you start with agents? Did you go to publishing houses? Can you talk a little bit about that?
Oh, sure. I started pitching at a couple of live conferences just to get some experience before I was really ready. It turned out one of those pitches ended up being the one where I got my agent. Mm-hmm. But after that, I spent about 6 months with query letters and did not get very far. Live pitching worked better for me.
Mm-hmm. And so once you got a hold, did you then go through an agent or did you go straight to a publisher? How did this book come into being?
So I had an agent, Erin Clyburn of Howland Literary, and she pitched it to publishers, and that's where we got our book deal with Falcon.
Wonderful. I love a good success story like that, because it is, it's a maze, right?
It was very hard. I mean, when I went through the query letter process, I mostly heard nothing, no answers, mm-hmm. and it was very demoralizing.
I know. I feel like, I mean, I've been through this in different projects and stuff, and I feel like I know this feeling. It's same when I submit to a literary magazine or any kind of editor. You push send, and inside I feel like, aha, my writing is going to change the world. And I can't wait until they see that. But then you realize, like, it's just another day, and I'm just one of so many. And it's really important to me, but it's just a number. You know, it's just another writer out there.
It's a very hard process. Yes.
Isn't it?
So vulnerable.
And so we have to hold on. Yes, we have to hold on to the gravity of what we've created and the joy that we had in accomplishing it, and then try to move it into the world to that next step. So yeah, I'm always in solidarity with all the writers, all of us at all these different stages. So before you had an agent, before you had your deal, let me get into the process of writing it and when you knew you needed to write the book. So I'm curious if you can reflect a little bit on when you knew you needed to write it and how much time passed from the inception to finishing this version, roughly, of the manuscript.
Yes, I wanted to write this story when I first got back to the mountain in 1988. That mm-hmm. obviously didn't happen and would have been a very different book. I put my head down, went through medical training, career, raising children. And then I read Cheryl Strayed's Wild at one point and thought, well, maybe it's not too late for me to tell my story, but then didn't for many, many more years. At one point in the middle, I transcribed my journal from Everest, still didn't write the book. And then 5 years ago, I resigned from a job in a sort of dramatic fashion. And the following morning, I went to my desk and just started writing. There was no planning, like, now I'm finally going to write this book. And that was 5 years ago. And I've been writing ever since.
Wow, that's amazing. So are you retired from a job?
I still do medicine one day a week. And otherwise, I'm mostly writing. But I also have my medical book that I'm still writing. And I do a lot of medical advocacy work. So
you're busy. You're very busy. I feel like you've done so much in your life. You've traveled to a range of locations. You've had different roles. And you really bring to life in the memoir the youth and your upbringing and the changes inside of you as you were trying to basically come of age. When were you aware of a writer you emerging and giving her the room that she needed to know that I might one day do this?
Mm-hmm. The writer me first emerged in high school. Before that, didn't think I could write a word. I was a voracious reader, like many writers, from an early age, you know, coming home with my stacks of library books and escaping into the stories. And in high school, you know, when you start to learn literature on a deeper level, I think some writing emerged because I know they selected me to be the editor for the prose and poetry section of the yearbook. But still, I didn't have any confidence writing. I wrote a lot, though. I wrote very detailed journals, which a lot of the memoir is based on, and very, very long letters to anyone I would meet. And it wasn't until now, writing this book and going back to the journals, that I did see that there were several years, especially in medical school, where I dreamed of being a writer. I locked that away so long because I framed my life around I really had given up this dream of being a dancer, which is where the book title comes from, and there's a dance theme through the memoir. But I also had really dreamed of being a writer, and, you know, I loved words always. I couldn't study enough SAT words. I it was like so much fun for me.
Said nobody before you.
In college, when I really had to study mostly science, I created my own curriculum of reading, and I would create long vocabulary lists and things like that. So it was a passion.
Yeah. Do you have a lot of energy?
Do I sound like I do?
No, I'm just wondering because I'm thinking about your summer jobs when you're in high school. I'm thinking about the dancing, and I'm thinking about how you managed to go through medical school, how you did these treks on your own, and how you were handling so many different roles while you were preparing to go on this expedition. Do you consider yourself someone to have a lot of energy?
I actually don't, Ranit. I actually don't think of myself as high energy, but I do admit to being kind of driven.
Yeah, no, I definitely think so. So there's so much I want to get into, and I guess we should start, before I dive into these questions about structure, I guess you should read the opening of your memoir that we talked about, At Risk, until the section where we talked about you would end, and then we'll discuss it.
Great, thanks. At Risk. May 1988, Kangshung Glacier, Tibet. We peered into the white. White snow, white clouds, white nothingness. The east face of Everest, where our route snaked through gullies, crevasses, and overhanging ice pinnacles, rose 2 miles into the Tibetan sky above. Our small team of six had 4 climbers, a photographer, and me, a 25-year-old medical student. The climbers were attempting a new route. They were purists, nimble, using no oxygen or Sherpa support. Joe, our photographer, sat on a blue barrel at Advanced Base Camp and searched through our telescope for the dark outlines of 3 climbers missing on the mountain. His eyes, finely tuned to details and shapes, shadows and forms, focused on the white slope. We'd last spotted the climbers days earlier, tiny dots ascending toward the summit, creeping over the edge of our route onto the South Col, the link between Tibet and Nepal, east and south, visible and invisible. We distinguished them by the color of their coats and hats, steadily inching up in the bright sunshine. Now there was no sun, just lackluster white, and our world of waiting felt like groping through darkness, except that everything was flat and stark and still. The tarp of our yellow tent flapped overhead, the wind electric with panic. I stretched out on my belly to Joe's right, propped up on my elbows, and rubbed my dry eyes, willing our friends into view, as if desire were a magnet. My teeth chattered, and my elbows burned from the pebbles dimpling them, so I piled sleeping bags over and under me. Our team's fourth climber, Paul, who'd been forced off the mountain days earlier due to altitude sickness, stood to Joe's left, just outside the tent. The three of us were on our own route, a route of waiting, tethered as if by climbing ropes. The landscape offered nothing, no tracks in the snow, no blasts of light from their headlamps, two flashes for safe, six for SOS. With no sign of them by dusk, my hopes for their return dwindled. They were in the death zone, an extreme elevation above 26,000 feet, where oxygen is a fraction of that at sea level, where muscles lag with lethargy, where the brain hungers for oxygen and thoughts stall and sink in a slush of gray matter, where the body rapidly decays and eventually stops functioning. No climber had ever survived more than 3 days in the death zone without supplemental oxygen. We were nearing the end of day six. Were our friends stranded in the cold, unable to make decisions, injured, or had a crushing wave of wind swept them off the mountain? Be strong, come back, I whispered into the whirling white.
Thank you. And so your book begins, and it's gripping, and it covers so much ground, which I keep saying. So I mean that in the best possible way, because you did manage to incorporate so much, including your backstory, your family's backstory, your early career, what it was like for you as a woman. And how did you land on the structure? How did you decide where to begin? And did you know the opening would be the opening early on, or did you have to massage that?
I massaged everything. Trial and error. I feel like I tried thousands of things. Mm-hmm. Structure.
Is this before you began querying?
Yes. Mm-hmm. So structure was definitely the hardest part. It was an early memoir class that a teacher had suggested starting at this dramatic moment. But I really tried. One person suggested a braiding approach, and I tried that, and then I put that away. Some people recommended chronological to not be confusing. Others said absolutely not chronological. So I played.
It's so hard, isn't
it? It's so hard. I played with a lot of things. So it opens with that dramatic thing. And the next chapter introduces the concept of me being an unlikely candidate and explains why I have to bring in my parents' story and how and why I ended up on the mountain. Because unlike the book I would have written at 25, that question was really interesting to me now. And then the next few chapters are more thematic. So the first kind of uses my body as a character, and then the next uses the concept of immersion, which I start out by talking about, you know, language immersion, but then that word kind of refers to the passions that drove me. And then it becomes fairly chronological. So I kind of tried different things.
Really hard, right? So how did you know that you landed on a structure that was working?
I don't know that I know that.
Well, okay. I'm going to ask you a loaded question or say something, which is I absolutely agree with the advice you got to start the book where you do. Have you come to feel like that was a good decision?
Yes. Although I have to tell you, So my book was accepted for publication, and I was then in a writer's workshop where I presented the first two chapters. The teacher knew I had the publication accepted already, and I was about 2 or 3 months away from submitting my manuscript. And she said, do not start here, which is, and, you know, some of the students came up to me and said they didn't agree with her, but, you know, I had a deep reach inside of me, and you know, I just knew this is where I wanted to start. So,
yeah. Well, do you remember what the recommendation was as to where you should start if it wasn't where you did start?
Yes, because the next chapter introduces my family, and she was very drawn to that.
Yeah. Well, this is a very fun thing to talk about, because I know for me, I will say that I got into the weeds when I was writing my memoir. I was told early on, different editors, different readers, well, we need to know more about your backstory. We need to know about like who your parents were. We need to know more who your father is, because later on he plays such an important role, blah, blah, blah. And I thought, well, that's just going to bore everyone. I can't spend pages and pages and pages with backstory where nothing much happens. I will lose my reader. So I knew I wanted to start with one of the most searing memories I had had, which is the first time my mom left in that moment. But then I thought, well, now I have to show people why this matters and why this is so particularly resonant and affecting to me because of where I'd been up until then. So then I go into some backstory, but I worried the whole time that I was going to lose my reader. I worried and worried and worried that it was just going to bore them. So that was something that I really worked on, was trying to calibrate that. And that's why I feel like our structures mirror each other just a smidge, although you're juggling far more plates in the air there, or spinning more plates in the air than I had to, because I didn't have as much chronology to deal with. But I do think it makes sense to start where you can get your reader hooked and rooting for you and turning the page always. I mean, that's always a good idea.
Right. And the way you just described it is exactly what I went through, and I worried about the backstory. And then, you know, it became a coming of age story. So is it backstory or forestory? It's a lot of worrying and trial and error. And, you know, not everyone's going to like the structure. And I had to settle on something.
But ultimately, yeah, I really think we all could write our books in many, many different ways, many different voices and approaches, many different chronologies, all the things. Like, there's countless ways to tell our stories. And ultimately, after our trusted readers, and I know you have a lovely writers group, because I'm friends with some of them too, because of our writing community, they helped you and your editors and your agent. Like, and then you have to just sort of, you know, just say it's out of your hands now. It's in the world, right?
Yes.
So let me ask you what next section you would like to read. We talked about a couple of different ones. I sent you some different ones. So this is Mimi's choice, and then you can set it up however you'd like.
Well, you suggested this, and I'm going to start with the invitation, the letter I got inviting me to the expedition.
Okay.
So a month later, in September 1986, I picked up Robert's letter from the mailroom and turned it over in my hand. I walked around my apartment with it. I smiled at it. I finally sat down and stared at it. Mimi, will you be ready in 1988 to fix up climbers in need? Ha! Robert, I wish! I yelped out loud to no one, tickled by his invitation to join an Everest expedition as a member of the assault team as the doctor. I was beginning my second year of medical school, the mnemonic for the bones of the hand still rattling through my head during a study break. I grinned about how far we'd come. When we met, I assumed we'd never see each other again and attributed our connection to the spell of the mountains. But he showed up in New York within a month of my return from Nepal, and I'd visited him once in Colorado. If we weren't in a relationship with others, we coupled up when we saw each other. Irene, my trekking partner from Nepal, had recently visited Robert in New Zealand. She wrote me, "You certainly need to teach me how to have this non-committal relationship with him," adding that she still liked and missed a climber she'd met in Nepal. From the moment Robert and I met, I'd placed our connection in a box, not letting my guard down about any relationship potential. My defunct relationship with Tom, my rumble boyfriend, had convinced me that long distance wouldn't work. I mulled over Robert's question. Would I be ready? Well, Robert, no, I wouldn't. I would be in my third year of medical school. Reading on, he also asked me to design a motivational eating program, plan a physical training program, and fundraise with corporate food and medical sponsors. He added in a scribble, "I'll eat anything except walnuts, pecans, and cashews." My heart raced, but then my head caught up. What is he thinking? I'm not a doctor, nutritionist, physical trainer, or fundraiser. I was a student sitting in my cramped bedroom in the Bronx, a striped cat named Sam in my lap, with a single window casting a trapezoidal amber glow on the hardwood floor. Attending classes all day, I spent the rest of my time studying. I was already immersed in a world foreign to me. New medical vocabularies, clinics, emergency rooms, procedures, protocols. Keeping up took every bit of my focus and energy. How would I enter the world of expedition planning, train for my role, convince people to financially support it? My mind raced with my mother's phrase, "Who do you think you are?" My parents did not seek adventure and risk, preferring to leave struggles for survival in the past.
Right. And there we get an echo a bit of the ancestors and the Holocaust. You know, we learn about that in your book and how both of your parents had to flee and just the legacy of all that on a young child growing up with that history, which you do talk about, and it does connect. You make it connect. And so I'm wondering what you make of the you that you were back in your early 20s, trekking alone, living the way you did, saying yes to these things.
Mm-hmm. I've got to think about her for a few years now. So she was a young woman who followed her curiosity in many directions and listened to a voice from deep inside. And I think it's what Vivian Gornick calls the inviolable self, or the true self, which is the same voice that drove me to write this book. You know, once I started writing, I was so just passionate and driven, and I couldn't stop even though a lot of it was hard. Mm-hmm. And what I've learned is when that voice makes itself known in my life, I just have to follow it. It's mm-hmm. kind of what drives my advocacy work too. And that curiosity, you know, first led me to the mountains. And then in the mountains, I found myself to be the happiest version of myself. So I wanted more of that. Mm. And that's what led me to backpack alone in Nepal. And that eventually led me to go to Everest. And that's also why I said yes to Everest, because that puzzles a lot of people. But, you know, so, you know, I think that girl was curious, dreamy, and driven, mm-hmm. and searching for her own, you know, figure out who she was, what she wanted out of life, what kind of life she wanted to leave, and this kind of independence, like fiercely independent. Mm-hmm. And I think that that is the cornerstone of what a coming of age story is. But I think of coming of age as something that many of us do throughout life. So I think, you know, we struggle mm-hmm. with those questions, you know, throughout our lives, yeah. I think.
There's someone in the book, I forgot who it is, but the quote is, "He met me while I was in the middle of a Zen trekking experience in Nepal," because he said you were a calming influence, that you are really good on the expedition because you're a calming influence. And you ask yourself, doesn't he realize a Jewish girl from New York City is not typically seen as a calming influence? And I really, for people who are not Jewish girls from New York City, can you please, you know, reflect on this for them? Like, yeah. Why, right? I mean, I know because I'm a Jewish girl from New York City.
Well, you'll understand that I put that line in and took it out and rewrote it many different ways because I thought I could be dinged for it. But it's true.
Oh, really?
It's true. So
wait. Who would ding you?
I don't know. Just saying that Jewish girls from New York City are more, you know, tend to be more neurotic, more excitable, you know, kind of like I am.
Why? But like, why are we like that? Or why is that the case, do you think?
That's a good question. I feel like I was exposed to a lot from a young age. And the city's energy is just so excitable. Mm. It's not, you know, the city, you're seeing everything from a young age. And I write about my city growing up, right? And gritty New York City and how I had to be tough at a young age and how that was unusual training actually for Everest and facing fear. Mm-hmm. But then he meets me after 2 months of trekking alone in Nepal, and I'm writing poems, and, you know, the glacier is talking to me, and I'm being all spiritual. So I had a laugh when he said that I was going to be this calming influence.
Yeah, honestly, that's like someone saying I'm a calm influence. Although I would say I'm calm. I'm a much more calm person now. You know, I teach and stuff, and I'm trying to step into these calmer, quieter shoes. But I definitely wasn't in the past. I wanted to ask you also about your family's background. I mentioned it a few minutes ago, but they are from Germany and Israel, and they suffered losses in the Holocaust. And you can correct me or specify anything that I get wrong here. The dynamic at home for you seemed volatile in many ways and different from how you've lived your life since, as far as I can tell. And you share the family history generously. And I'm wondering what you were hoping for the reader to understand about you and who you were and the people you came from when you were writing Tap Dancing on Everest.
Yeah, so that became really important to me, to be a voice from what's called the generation after, or the children of Holocaust survivors, because the survivors themselves are passing on. And I didn't know that I would do all of this. You know, as I said, I always kind of wanted to tell my adventure story. And then when I started writing, all this family stuff came out, and I didn't know what I was going to make of that. But as, the more I wrote, that became really important to me, to kind of try to capture this generation, but also how it was hard for us children to understand the lives they led and the lives that we were leading. I don't remember the line exactly, but I, you know, they had to face life and death, and we had cereal and cartoons, you know. Most of my parents' friends were also Jewish immigrants and Holocaust survivors, and these people to me were all larger than life characters. They all had accents. And the more I wrote, I just wanted to honor them and their strength, but also be honest about how they affected us, which was not easy for many of us. And, you know, my father was the only survivor of his family in the Holocaust. His parents and siblings were killed. And so this became about, you know, how, you know, we were affected by that.
I really appreciated too the way that you rendered your family. I feel like you did it in a non-judgmental way, and you offered specifics and dialogue and showed them and allowed the reader to make decisions for themselves or to understand what it might have been like for you without blame or raking anyone over the coals. And that's something that I feel really strongly about in most cases when we're writing memoir.
Yeah, you did such a beautiful job of that in your book too. And that's what I really, that's how I strive to depict them. You know, tell my story truthfully. But, you know, what I've lived with my whole life is that they were doing their best, you know.
And there is so much love there too. I mean, there's just such a fierce energy. And actually, that's what I was going to ask you before. I was going to say, do you see yourself as courageous? Because I would never, ever do what you did. I'm a little scaredy cat. And also, because of my early life, I definitely never seek any kind of risk. Like, I just don't. It's just the way I responded to it. So when I think about you in your 20s doing this trekking and this expedition, I mean, I see someone who's incredibly courageous. Did you experience yourself that way?
Not at all, which I hope you get also in my character in the book. I didn't. I felt driven. So I did it because I had to do it, but I was full of fear as I did it. So I was always struggling with my fears and facing them and growing from them. And that is part of why I wrote the book, though, because I feel that we all, you know, have these choices really in our everyday lives, small choices and big choices that contain a lot of fear and risk. And I think that when we do take on the harder ones that include vulnerability, you know, we grow from that. You know, so I grew enormously from all these experiences, but none of them were easy.
And you write in detail about the temperature, the elevation, the climate, and what you're putting up with, but not in at all in any kind of complainy way. You're just, these are the facts. And then there's also, when you're doing the expedition, there are these people who are helping you, the porters and other people. And then at some points you're assaulted or nearly assaulted because you're the only woman there. And so you're navigating, I mean, in a summary, if I can even capture all of it, you're navigating being the medical go-to person for everyone on your expedition, being the only woman, dealing with the elevation and the climate, dealing with the uncertainty of what's going to happen, dealing with, you know, violence or, you know, potential violence and sexism, and dealing also with being an American in places where you have so much more than the people around you.
Yes, that's another reason I wanted to tell the story is I wanted to tell a woman's story, because a lot of expedition stories are just about the mountaineers or about the heroic, incredible feats they do, which I love reading, and I love those stories. And there are two other books about our expedition and a third that mentions them. Remember, there were only six people on our team. But I wanted to tell the woman's story because I felt in many ways I was in the background, and you know, I had my own sort of challenges in Everest. My what I call my Everest, which was being the doctor mm-hmm. as a medical student. But yeah, I often felt very lonely as a woman in that, you know, as women, we discuss everything. We process everything by talking to each other, right? And I had no other woman mm-hmm. to like decompress and talk to. So I'd go to my tent and I'd listen to Joni Mitchell and Joan Armatrading and Blondie. And, you know, and then there were all the other things you're mentioning. I was mm-hmm. harassed by the locals and, you know, multiple times. And then I'd have to ask the guys to intervene, which I resented. I didn't want them to have yeah. to intervene and, you know, stand up for me. I wanted to stand up for myself. But at a certain point, you know, I had yeah. to do that and come up with my own strategies where I wouldn't be alone and subject to that, yeah. you know, where I could still offer medical care, but when I wasn't alone on the trail.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's a lot of different directions that you're being pulled. So now I would love you to read that third excerpt we talked about, and you can set it up if you'd like.
Sure. On the way to base camp, we had terrible snowstorms and we were stuck for weeks in the snow, but then finally the weather cleared. So this is where this starts. The next day, the climbers and I walked up to the pass. I wished I could bottle the light, fresh air. To feel healthy, fully acclimatized, and enjoying good weather amounted to a high for all of us. That night, Robert opened some pockets in his duffel. Here's where I keep my passport, money, and papers, and my family contact information. Stop, you'll be fine, I said with a jolt of panic. Robert was such a force that I couldn't imagine him not returning from the mountain. I also couldn't picture my life with him gone. No, his face was serious. It's important for you to know. I didn't want to talk about it. All I wanted at that moment was the warmth of his arm around me in this cold cocoon. When we closed our eyes to sleep or opened them upon awakening, we envisioned only the mountain and what we would be doing there. With the developing intimacy of our group, even if I didn't want to think about terrible possible outcomes, I periodically took out my medical binder and quizzed myself on how to handle emergencies. I reviewed the temperature of water needed to thaw frostbitten fingers, the dose of epinephrine to revive a stopped heart. Seeing the east face at the pass, I couldn't ignore the high stakes riding on my shoulders. On March 24th, a light snow fell when porters trickled into camp at 4 a.m. We distributed loads and were short 35 people. We'd planned for yaks to carry our stuff. But now, people of all ages bent under the weight of our blue barrels, a troubling image of the disparities in our fortunes and privilege. We paid the wages set by the Chinese, but was it enough? I'd been so focused on preparing for my medical role, I hadn't thought about the impact of us being here, about my relationship with the locals, medical interactions with them, or being a foreign woman in this remote valley.
Thank you. Was it at all complicated for you to talk about your relationship with Robert in this book?
It was, because especially when I started the book, I really didn't want to, that wasn't like the point of my story, and I didn't want to really do it. But, you know, the more readers and the more I worked with her, like people were just curious and wanted to know more and more and more. And then, you know, my best friend read it and she's like, well, if it's coming of age, you know, you've got to include some relationships. And so I did include some.
She's like, yeah. Give me the dirt.
And it's funny because there's no sex in the book, but I've had a few readers who are personal friends say, I really wish there was some sex scenes. And I thought, it's odd for, like, you want to read it, a sex scene about me?
You have to say, check yourself. But I mean, what was going on for you when you thought about it? So something that comes to mind is, you know, here is this young woman who is trying to prove herself and does and is a doctor in training and is plucky and really, in my opinion, courageous, despite, you know, the ruminations and the self-doubt you had. Of course you were courageous. And yet there's this man there, right, that, you know, you don't want to have a relationship with him. You're both involved with other people in many parts of the book, and yet you do, which is not necessarily in keeping with, like, a heroine's journey, maybe, or in thinking of yourself as this, like, you know, trailblazer on your own, right? You are connected with him. You need his warmth. He has a tent for you. It's nice to be with him, right? He is, like, the boss of the expedition, so there's that, and you're trying not to let people know about it. Now, this isn't at all scandalous. You don't do it in any kind of seedy or secretive way. It's just what happens. And so I just wondered what you thought about in terms of trying to render it on the page.
Yeah, and we didn't keep it a secret. I mean, you know, we had had a past. And, you know, I say before the trip, I wasn't invited as a girlfriend. You know, we were seeing other people. The last thing I thought is that we would get involved again. You know, these things happen when you're young and you might be the strongest, fiercest feminist. I say it, you know, one or two times, you know, maybe I failed as a feminist in these moments. But I also have, you know, empathy for my 25-year-old young female self. You know, this is what happens. You know, we want relationship. Mm-hmm. And it was very cold on that mountain.
This is just about the weather, okay? Are you still
yes,
in touch
and
with him?
Actually, we have a great relationship. I'm in touch with all of them and with all of my exes. But, you know, had him read it a good year or two ago. And he's very generous. You know, he's an interesting character, right? You know, I write about how we first met and how arrogant I thought he is. And, you know, that's part of his personality. But he was so kind. He said, you know, first of all, it's your story to tell. And, you know, some of the way I treated you in the end is hard for me to read, but it's all true. And, you know, I fully support this book. And he's only been supportive.
Yeah. I mean, I gather that. I mean, it just comes across, right? It just does to as much as I can see, you know, without knowing what happened after. When you think about the book, aside from the structure, which was tricky to decide on and finally settle on, what other elements, when you think about your writing process, were particularly challenging to you and how did you solve them?
Yes, I think particularly with memoir, it was hard to get the two narrators, you know, the one telling the story and then the reflective narrator, and to do that subtly without taking the reader out of the story. That was challenging. And then one of the things that helped me was what Vivian Gornick talks about in this situation in the story, which is to look at yourself as a protagonist and not as yourself. And I found that really helpful, especially in memoir. I don't know if you felt this way, but, you know, writing about yourself and thinking about yourself for years, I got sick of myself, you know?
Yeah.
And so it really helped me to think of that character as separate from myself. She goes into much deeper ways to do that. And it really helped me then to think about the reader. So I love when they say the first draft of your memoir is for yourself, right? You're just writing. And that year was magical for me. I just wrote. I woke up in the middle of the night thinking about everything I wanted to write. You know, I wrote constantly and loved every minute of it. Then you have this big pile of stuff that's not very good, and you have to figure out what to do with it. And so then, you know, they say that the subsequent drafts are for the reader. And I really liked thinking about the reader, but some of that was challenging too, because they would, you know, there's advice, trust your reader and don't reveal too much, you know, reveal what the reader wants to know, what needs to know in that moment. And I'd be like, how am I going to figure that out? I know everything, you know, I'm not the reader.
And so how did you solve that? I mean, I have an answer to how I solved that. How did you figure it out?
Again, I think just a lot of trial and error. And one thing I really tried not to do is over-explain and trust the reader. And I think you touched a little on that with me showing scenes, but not explaining them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we could see you in the room, see you interacting with your mom, for example, or your father, but you didn't. You know, I don't want to, you know, be redundant, but you just showed it so we could make our own assessment and decisions. And I think also when it comes to trusting the reader or giving them too much or too little, that also is something that can be really hard to calibrate, especially when you're on a new project or you're newer at it, because you just don't know and you don't want to hit them over the head, but you don't want that it to be so, you know, hard to understand that they're not getting what you're saying. And that's, I think that's practice, but it also for sure is readers and editors, trusted readers and editors who say, exactly. All right, already, you already told us this, that's enough already. Yeah. Or I don't understand this. You know, there's just a stage for everything. And I love that you talk about how the first draft is just for you. And of course, it's wonderful when we finish, but then we've got all this material and then we have to deal with it. So it's like, why do any of us write?
Yeah, it's so hard. But you said you know how you solved it. How is that?
Yeah, that's how I solve it is kind of how I just answered, which is that, A, I was so impatient when I was a newer writer, so impatient to just get to that point where I could trust myself, where I could submit an essay without having to send it to a friend. You know, it was so important to me to be independent that way. And I was in workshop groups for a long time. And now I'm at a point where unless I'm having a real problem with something that I can't figure out, I do just send it on my own and wait for an editor to say yes or no or to fix it. And then in terms of knowing how much to share, whether you've gone too hard on details or whether you need to pare back, that to me is always trusted readers, beta readers, and, you know, if necessary or when it's time, an editor who will tell you, okay, you've repeated yourself a lot here on this. We don't need that description, right? So that, you know, we need our community.
We do, but then as you say, it's so important. And I don't know that I'm at this stage where you just completely trust yourself and you know you can't get too many opinions. If I told you the opinions I got on this whole story, you would be shocked that I ever finished the book and submitted it. I was told you can't write about your family in Everest. That's two books. Write only about your Everest adventure. Then I was told don't write about Everest. It's overdone. Then if you are going to write, you need a hook. Wow. And if I said there's no other book by a woman doctor on Everest, I was told, well, that might mean there's no interest in one.
So wait, how did you stay focused into what made you keep on going then?
I think it was just this drive. I just had to do it. I had to tell this story and I had to figure out a way to tell the one I wanted to tell.
Yeah. And that's why we do these things. I mean, there's no way we would finish these projects if we didn't feel compelled.
Yes, compelled. And don't take everyone's opinion so seriously. I think it's great to listen to opinions, but some people give their opinions as if they're facts. And, you know.
Yes. Yes. And also it's easy as an earlier or younger or newer writer to take what are opinions as facts and to think that someone knows so much more than you that you must listen to them.
Yes.
And that calibration, as I mentioned, was really tricky for me to know. You know, I just wanted to know it already on my own. And that's not to say that I'm right all the time. And recently, or I think it was last year, I kept sending something out and it was getting rejected. But I thought, I like this. I still like this. Am I out of my mind? And I sent it to a co-editor where I worked. And she said, no, keep going. This is great, blah, blah, blah. And eventually found a home.
Great.
But it doesn't mean it was like, whatever, right? It's just a piece of writing. It's not going to change anyone's life that much. But, you know, it made me really happy to be able to have it accepted. And how did you, aside from Vivian Gornick and the situation in the story, which book, you know, I love that book, how did you land on figuring out your reflective narrator and your character? How did you manage that ultimately? How did you figure it out?
I think it was a lot of craft classes. I took many classes, workshops, webinars, conferences, and read a lot of craft books. And did a lot of, again, trial and error. Working with my writing group was invaluable. You mentioned them before, but we are four memoirists. We've gone through each other's books twice before we finished them. And, you know, that really helped. It helped to have trusted friend writers. As you mentioned, you evolve with time. You gain some skills. And then you try to apply them.
So what advice would you like to give writers working on their memoirs?
Well, you mentioned one, which is to have patience with yourself, which I had little of. I think because I started at an older age, I wasn't very patient with myself. So I think you need to let the story unfold and, you know, let it breathe and have patience. And that may take time. And the story you think you want to tell might evolve into something else. You know, I mentioned all the sources that helped me. So I think that's important. The nice thing about a writing group is, you know, if something you're doing isn't working or rings untrue, you know, you get to hear it from a trusted friend in a safe space, you know, rather than someone who may not be as kind to you.
Yes. And you mentioned Vivian Gornick's book, The Situation in the Story. Are there other books or memoirs you'd like me to list in the show notes that you feel informed your work and that you want to recommend?
Well, I think reading memoirs, of course, helps a lot with craft. My favorite memoir of recent years was Heavy by Kie St. Lehmann. Since John Krakauer is masterful in the adventure genre, I read all of his works and essays. And also with Vivian Gornick, her memoir, Fierce Attachments, is just wonderful. I read that after a New York Times article rated it as number one memoir of the 50 memoirs in the last 50 years. And same with Joan Didion. You know, she was she was a big influence. And I mentioned Wild, which really inspired me to write my book. And in terms of craft books, one I wish I had read earlier was Make a Scene by Jordan Rosenfeld. Really liked that. And I read some other, you know, memoir books by Marion Roach Smith and Barrington, the book by Philip Lopate, To Show and to Tell. And I know we all like Anne Lamott's Bird by Bird. So those were all great books to read.
Those are, I'm so glad you mentioned those, because sometimes craft books don't get shouted out on the show as much. So that's really great.
And then many of us are familiar with the great literary citizen Allison K. Williams, but her book Seven Drafts is just so helpful for editing, you know, before you send off to an editor.
Allison, I love the fact that you mentioned a couple of people who've been on the show, which makes me super extra happy.
That's great.
So great. So now, Mimi, where can people find you and get your book and all that?
My website is MimiZemanMD.com. On socials, I'm at MimiZemanMD. I also have a free Substack called Medicine, Mountains, and More, which combines medical news with inspiration from art and nature. And the book is available at all online retailers, hopefully in some bookstores. It comes out April 2nd.
Great. Well, this was lovely, and I am so happy we had the chance to talk and that I got to read your story, and I wish you just an amazing time getting this book into the world.
Thank you so much for your part playing in that, Rini, and it was delightful to talk to you. Thank you.
Thank you for tuning in to Let's Talk Memoir. For more about this episode and my guest, please visit the link in the show notes or on Instagram at Ronit Plank. That's RONITPLANK. You can also follow me on Twitter, Facebook, and TikTok. If you liked this episode of Let's Talk Memoir, please go ahead and share it with your friends and subscribe. And if you have two more seconds, you can rate and review it on Apple Podcasts, which really does help other people find the show. Thank you so much for being here.